For the first time in decades, North Korea has a new strategy. It's making new friends, new enemies, and soon, quite possibly, a new kind of trouble. The situation on the Korean Peninsula is more dangerous than it has been since 1950, wrote two experts earlier this year. We think of North Korea as this incredibly isolated, backward, and rebellious hermit kingdom. And that's all true. Yet, it's about to become far more isolated, far more backward, and far more rebellious than the world has ever seen. We may soon look back at the last 20 years as a golden age, a brief window of relative openness and optimism. North Korea, of course, never went as far as China. But while there were never McDonald's in Pyongyang, the regime tolerated a surprising amount of capitalism, a rising middle class, and even a few tourists, about 350,000 in 2019. But, as we're about to find out, none of this was inevitable. What makes this grand strategic pivot especially troubling is that the warning signs are nearly invisible. To all but the closest observers, they simply look like more of the same. Take, for instance, what happened several weeks ago, when Kim Jong-un destroyed this 100-foot arch representing Korean unity, announcing that after 75 years, peaceful unification is no longer possible. In an earlier age, this may have been laughed at as a childish, impulsive outburst. But by now, we've grown desensitized. Here he goes again, we say, rolling our eyes and quickly moving on. In this view, Kim Jong-un is still a child, but one who masterfully manipulates his parents, throwing tantrums until they acquiesce, buying him candy. By destroying that giant concrete arch, it assumes, Kim is merely recycling the same tired strategy. First, escalate by blowing something up. Sometimes figuratively, often literally. Second, just before tensions reach a boiling point, start negotiating. And finally, extract as much as possible in exchange for merely returning to the status quo. Understandably, Americans have grown tired of our attention and resources being hijacked by this childish behavior. Why should we, the parents, reward it, thereby encouraging more tantrums? So, we've started to ignore. We've shifted our attention to more pressing issues: China, Russia, and the Middle East. But what if we're wrong? Or what if we were right, but things have changed? Admittedly, that theory is very convincing. It almost perfectly explains the country's behavior. After all, this isn't the first time Kim Jong-un has destroyed a large physical symbol of peace. In 2021, he very dramatically blew up this four-story office building for joint North and South cooperation. In fact, you could argue it fits a little too well. Anything North Korea does could be seen as evidence. If it acts aggressively, it must be in that first escalation phase. If not, it must be in that second negotiation phase. Either way, it's just fishing for attention, and thus we should simply ignore. This, of course, is its own fault. North Korea is the definition of the boy who cried wolf. After decades of polluting the airwaves with an endless cycle of positive followed by negative signals, there's almost nothing it can do to regain our attention. And that's where we're at now. Having responded to its cry for help and feeling like a fool so many times before, we've completely moved on. Statistically, this is probably wise. We'd be foolish not to consider North Korea's past behavior. Still, we'd also be foolish to lose all humility. After all, wolves do exist, and two widely respected experts are currently warning us that they see one coming. In January, Robert Carlin, a former U.S. State Department official, and Siegfried Hecker, a nuclear scientist, both of whom have visited North Korea, published a letter arguing that this time may be different, that these are not routine provocations. So, skeptical as you may be, suspend your disbelief for a moment and consider this alternate interpretation of history. From the very beginning, Kim Il-sung was supremely anxious about his tiny nation's tenuous place in the world. And, frankly, for good reason. The United States openly considered using nuclear weapons during the Korean War, a war, it should be noted, that never officially ended. Thus, North Korea immediately began building a bomb of its own. That work would end up taking over half a century, during which it occasionally slowed down or even paused development to negotiate with the US and others. Opinions differ on whether it could have been persuaded to change course during this 50-year period. Some argue it was driven only by vulnerability, that if the US had made it feel secure, nuclear weapons would have become more trouble than they're worth. Others believe it was entirely unreachable, that negotiating was only about buying time. In any case, it doesn't matter. The United States never made North Korea feel secure. North Korea may not have stopped building the bomb anyway. And even if it would have, everything changed in 2011. That year, Muammar Gaddafi was brutally and very publicly killed after voluntarily giving up Libya's nuclear weapons program. Less than 2 months later, Kim Jong-il died of a heart attack and was succeeded by his youngest son, Kim Jong-un. Having been so recently and so vividly reminded of what can happen after surrendering nuclear weapons, Kim Jong-un doubles, triples, quadruples down. Over the next 3.5 years, he tests more missiles than his father and grandfather did in the previous 30. Now, so far, none of this is especially controversial. North Korea, particularly after 2011, was clearly intent on going nuclear. The difference, where this interpretation diverges from the conventional one, is what Kim imagined would happen next. In this version, Kim Jong-un doesn't want his country to remain this strange, isolated hermit kingdom. He's not building nuclear weapons, at great cost, merely to keep things as they are, to prevent an American invasion so he can keep eating Swiss cheese and terrorizing the South forever. No, instead he imagines North Korea becoming a more normal country. One that freely trades with other economies and that the world respects as a legitimate sovereign member of the international community. The US, for example, has a complex and often tense relationship with, say, Saudi Arabia. It strongly opposes many of its actions and even finds some of them morally reprehensible. Regardless, it would never joke about overthrowing its prince. There's some basic respect that the country has a right to exist and that its government should be taken seriously. That, or something like it, is what Kim had in mind. He looks, in other words, at the 8 other countries with nuclear weapons, several of which are not exactly friends with the United States, and perhaps naively thinks North Korea can join them. Once we prove that we can destroy them, he assumes, they'll have no choice but to treat us like an adult. The problem, of course, is that he's wrong. So very comically wrong. Not only are the Americans most definitely not willing to accept a nuclear North Korea, avoiding that outcome is practically the only thing they care about. Every US administration, from Clinton to Bush, Obama, and Trump, has proven this fact. Washington is willing to suffocate civilians with crippling sanctions. It's willing to strain its all-important relationship with China in the process. The one thing it's never, ever, ever been willing to accept is a nuclear North Korea. In 1964, in 2024, and likely for the foreseeable future, America sees the country as little more than an undisciplined child. This fundamental misunderstanding came to a head in 2017, as North Korea finally accomplished a goal it had long been working toward: the ability to plausibly target the US mainland. Surely, if anything would force the Americans to take us seriously, it's the ability to wipe out San Francisco with the press of a button. They'll see that it's too late to stop us from going nuclear, and wisely cut their losses. We'll stop testing missiles, they'll start lifting sanctions, and everyone can let out a big sigh of relief. Meanwhile, Kim is thinking, here's this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. A US president who won't stick to the same decades-old script, and whose personal brand is synonymous with making deals. And he's not wrong. Donald Trump was, by all accounts, extremely eager to strike a deal. After all, what better way to boost his odds of re-election and cement his legacy than to resolve an issue that a dozen of his predecessors couldn't? Think about it. The conditions had never been so ripe. Both sides were optimistic. So optimistic that when they failed to make a deal in Singapore in 2018, they tried again in Vietnam in 2019. Then, when they failed in Vietnam, they tried a third time later that year at the demilitarized zone. Yet, as hard as they tried, and as often as they tried, a simple fact remained. The only thing Washington wanted, the complete and verifiable removal of all nuclear weapons, was the only thing Pyongyang refused to offer. Now, for Washington, this was surely disappointing, perhaps even embarrassing. But the media's attention span is short, and the world's only superpower always has bigger fish to fry. For North Korea, on the other hand, this was nothing short of devastating. Three attempts, three failures, all under the best possible circumstances. Consider the soul-searching Kim Jong-un must have done during that 60-hour train ride back from Hanoi. Especially when, after all that enthusiasm and momentum, the world just moved on. Here, you can finally do what your grandfather only dreamed of, sink the state of California into the ocean. And yet, you're having a harder time than ever even getting America's attention, much less respect. In fact, far from it, nuclear weapons only made it that much more of a pariah. And no longer the bold, threatening kind of pariah. North Korea had become irrelevant. As the pandemic, tensions with China, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and conflict in the Middle East dominated the front page, North Korea was relegated to the comics. But the Kim regime is nothing if not adaptable. It started searching for new opportunities, rethinking its approach, and charting a radical strategic pivot. First, however, we need to address what may seem like a gap in this explanation. Why would North Korea have wanted to abandon its neighbors and realign itself with the West, to become a normal country? Or, to put it differently, given its anti-American propaganda, how could it ever abandon the socialist cause, the Eastern Bloc, the Axis of Evil? At the heart of these questions is a popular yet pernicious myth that North Korea, China, and Russia are close friends. Like any good myth, it contains an element of truth. Without the support of its two larger neighbors during the Korean War, the DPRK wouldn't exist today. It's also true that China supplies the regime with the coal, oil, and grain it needs to survive. It alone is responsible for about 90% of North Korea's global trade. But we also know there's far more here than meets the eye, and there always has been. While Kim Il-sung sought Chinese and Soviet approval before invading the South in 1950, he waited 3 days after doing so to inform Beijing and initially refused its help. 2 years later, amid a costly stalemate, Kim was ready to sign a truce. Mao vetoed his wishes and continued fighting for another 18 months. Then, after a truce was signed, the Chinese army lingered in North Korea. This made Kim Il-sung nervous, and he began purging pro-Chinese and Soviet officials. For a brief moment, Mao considered helping him, quote, correct his mistakes. As we know, Mao never followed through on this threat, but these tensions never quite vanished entirely. As the Chinese-Soviet relationship deteriorated throughout the 60s and 70s, North Korea played the two parties off each other, switching alliances to the highest bidder, not unlike a child manipulating his divorced parents. Needless to say, this was a pretty good gig while it lasted. Then, everything fell apart. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, North Korea lost its most lucrative patron overnight. Not 12 months later, it lost the next closest thing it had to an ally when China established relations with South Korea. This, along with China's embrace of capitalism, invasion of its former ally, Vietnam, and rapprochement with the US, led North Korea to call its neighbor a, quote, traitor to the socialist cause. China and Russia were still willing to trade with the country, but with the Cold War over, they were no longer offering their Korean brothers the family discount. The days of charity were over. They asked to be paid in cold, hard cash. Cash that North Korea didn't have. Over the next 5 years, as much as 15% of its population died of starvation. But while China quietly watched this tragedy unfold without intervening, it couldn't let go completely. It still wanted to keep North Korea alive, if only because the alternative would be so much worse. If the DPRK collapsed, the US-backed South could advance all the way up to the Chinese border, and 25 million refugees might come flooding into its struggling northeastern Rust Belt. So, to prevent this outcome, China allowed its trade to steadily increase throughout the 2000s, during which time Beijing became increasingly integrated into the global economy. In other words, what it really didn't need was a war. And North Korea was picking fights. Its provocations were scaring the Americans, the Japanese, and the South Koreans, who were fortifying their defenses in response right on China's border. Annoyed, China asked North Korea to please settle down. But believe it or not, North Korea is not a very good neighbor. Not only was it not receptive to Beijing's polite request, but it went out of its way to bite the hand that was, quite literally, feeding it. In 2017, it launched missiles right before Xi Jinping met Trump in Florida, hours before Xi gave a speech at the BRICS summit, and on the same day as China's Belt and Road Forum. Just in case Beijing wasn't getting the message, Kim executed his uncle by firing squad, who was notoriously close with China. And 3 years later, his half-brother, who had been living in the Chinese Special Administrative Region of Macau. Now infuriated, China and Russia sent a message of their own, both voting in favor of the toughest ever UN sanctions against North Korea. Its trade immediately collapsed in a striking parallel to the 1991 fall of the Soviet Union. Once again, Pyongyang was on its own. Clearly, whatever you call this, it's certainly not friendship. It should be obvious by now that the three countries share only the most basic interest, keeping North Korea alive. Beyond that, their goals are almost diametrically opposed. In an ideal Chinese or Russian world, North Korea is trapped in a coma, while they act as its guardian, keeping it on permanent life support. Merely taking up space where the Americans can't. The weaker it is and the more dependent, the better. Whereas North Korea wants to maximize its independence. And it does this by antagonizing its neighbors. This is the key to understanding its new strategy. To see how all this comes together, let's return to the most basic question. How much do we know about North Korea? The answer is, not much. Because we know so little, we're forced to speculate, to start sketching an image based on a few assumptions. For example, we assume that these Cold War alliances were and remain unbreakable. Then, over time, we filled in details by extrapolating further and further. We assume that North Korea would never abandon its allies, Therefore, it must be insincere about making a deal. Therefore, these latest developments are simply more of the same. Eventually, we end up with this incredibly photorealistic painting. We're certain that by destroying the unification arch, Kim is merely returning to his usual playbook, and that we can safely ignore these provocations. Experts, however, are warning us not to confuse this vivid detail with accuracy. Once we revisit our assumption that North Korea is best friends with China and Russia, the entire painting and all of its detail change. We see that it's always been trying to break free from their shadow, and that the US offered a way out. This was Kim Jong-un's motive for making a deal. To endorse this interpretation, you need not trust Kim Jong-un. You need only accept that it's in his best interest to decrease his dependence on China and Russia, two countries that have repeatedly abandoned their North Korean brothers when convenient. By destroying the arch, Kim was performing, yes, but also communicating, the only way he knows how, that the days of negotiating are over, or at least that the terms have changed. No longer is it even pretending to pursue peaceful unification. Which brings us back to the present day. North Korea was on one path, the path to gradually becoming a more normal country. With no plans to give up its nuclear trump card, it was finally ready to relax, to stop testing missiles, and to gradually integrate with the global economy. Then, it unexpectedly hit a devastating dead end. After failing to strike a deal with the US, it was forced to devise a new strategy. But as one door closed, two new ones opened: Russia's global isolation and China's ideological resurgence. North Korea saw its opportunity to return to the Cold War dynamic. 30 years after history ended, Pyongyang once again has strategic value, which means greater support from its neighbors. Think about it this way. For the past 3 decades, China and Russia have grown irritated with their neighbor, who they had little use for. And yet, look at all the trouble North Korea managed to create on its own. Now that it's being given an even longer leash, it stands to reason that Pyongyang will be on even worse behavior. And we're already beginning to see what that looks like. North Korea was one of just 5 countries to vote against a UN resolution condemning Russia's invasion of Ukraine, something even China abstained from. Since then, Kim Jong-un has contributed missiles, drones, and other weapons to Russia's war. In return, Russia helped North Korea launch military satellites. Today, as during the Cold War, the 3 countries are very far from best friends. The last 30 years have only deepened their distrust. Still, they momentarily serve each other's interests. And that alone is plenty cause for concern. To see what these reluctant comrades are capable of when they work together, we need only look a few generations back. Until the start of South Korea's economic miracle in the 1980s, it was Seoul, not Pyongyang, that lagged behind economically. Thanks to Soviet and Chinese aid, North Korea's per capita GDP was significantly higher. These and other historical oddities, which may offer some clues about what to expect in this new era, are covered in much greater detail in this fascinating real-life lore video about the Korean Peninsula. It charts its entire modern history, starting all the way back with Japanese occupation. This is just one of over 30 mini-documentaries in the Modern Conflict series, exclusively available on today's sponsor, Nebula. Nebula is the streaming platform built by your favorite creators, like Real Engineering, TLDR News, Not Just Bikes, Legal Eagle, Wendover Productions, and yours truly. On Nebula, there are no ads, videos like these are often available early, and you get exclusive access to original series that will never air on YouTube. Originals like my 6-part series, China Actually. In the most recent episode, we cover the one-child policy, why it was enacted, why it wasn't dismantled until 2015, by which time China's population was already headed towards serious decline, and how effective the policy was or wasn't. By signing up to Nebula, you also get access to Nebula classes, where you can learn from some of your favorite channels. Now, normally, Nebula costs $5 a month, but you can get it for 50% off by signing up for a year with the link on screen or in the description now. That's just $2.50 a month for an entire streaming service.